Thank you very much indeed, Alistair. That was very kind of you. I think there's one thing I would like to say in praise of the University of Sussex, having spent this time, and that is it's a very flexible university. I've been able to change my activities quite frequently in appropriate ways. In other words, as long as one did one's job and, as it were, attracted students or research, whatever it was, the flexibility was there for one to change and open up new areas and move with them. And because the other thing I should say was, given that my only formal training was my doctorate in chemistry, nearly all the learning that I've had to do during the course of this time moving things has been really learning through the work that I did, but particularly from my students. Because the very unusual feature of my career was that from the very beginning, I was working with people who were mature professionals working on responsible jobs on the sorts of things that they found problematic and wanted to work on. So it was very much a question of, in a sense, trying to support groups so that they could help each other. And in a sense, when I first began, the situation was quite open, and it was only a diploma course that I was first asked to run. So we organized those around practical assignments in people's schools. This was for teachers originally. And it wasn't because I had some brilliant education idea. It was simply that nobody told me what education courses were supposed to be like. And that seemed to me the obvious way to do it. And I certainly couldn't organize it so I taught them how to do their jobs. So it had to be some way by which they helped each other to do their jobs in some sort of way. So basically what might sound like an innovation was actually an act of desperation. But so that's the way that those kind of things happen, I suppose. And the university has the kind of flexibility to accommodate those sorts of activities, to allow people to try and pioneer and get together and do things that are practical and useful and helpful. Now, I move on to my lecture. Now, perhaps I ought to explain that it's really the last 15 years that I've had this major interest in doing a lot of research in the area of professional learning. Prior to that, it had been an interest of mine, but it wasn't really very possible to get much research funding in that sort of area. And one of the interesting questions is, why did the situation change? Did it become possible in 92? It was a useful time because I just stopped being dean, so I had some mulling time to myself again, which is good when you're starting research. The mulling time is very important. So two things had happened there. One of them I would describe as the failure of expert systems, which there is a very strong element coming through from psychology and computer science, that one could, in a sense, create images of expertise that one could handle in computerized contexts. And this was in the early 80s, before an awful lot of things had happened in computer science that are there today. And it clearly was shown that it really wasn't quite succeeding in that sense. It wasn't, you know, really providing systems that could do what experts did and so on. But it did draw people's attention to it. And the other thing that was happening was what I would call the discourse of competencies. And that was coming through very strongly at that time. And that, again, was something that people couldn't ignore. Now, I had a particular take on this from the beginning. The first was that competency was a very key concept in a democracy. I've done quite a lot of work on accountability, and I'm well aware of the dangers of professions sometimes at certain stages and phases in their lives, not perhaps giving as much attention to the democratic aspect of our lives as they might or would be appropriate. So the concept of competence to me was very central to this, and it's central in the sense to people trusting people from the professions to do the work that they do. But on the other hand, when people started trying to do things with this and to create things out of it, we got something that didn't really match. In other words, the discourses of competence failed to appreciate the nature of professional knowledge, and they certainly didn't understand the complexity of most professional work. So we had an idea that had an important democratic centre to it, completely failing to work when it started being turned into practical things on the ground. And this meant that there was a lot of space to begin to move into this area and work with people in all sorts of ways to try and find ways forward from that. And some of the work I did then was in the vocational area, conjunction with people in the Department of Employment and the training agency and so on, and some of it was working with various professions. So that was how the thing kind of started. And as you got moved in, you became more and more aware of where some of the problem areas were, and you began to work with different groups to try and move those along a little bit. Now, one of my interests has always been in professional knowledge, but that's not my main subject tonight. But it is what my first three slides are going to be about. Because a little introduction to this is needed in order to understand professional learning. Because you can't totally ignore what it is that people are learning. And if people are learning complex and difficult things, then simple approaches to learning aren't necessarily the most appropriate ways of supporting that. So what this slide really talks about is an attempt to begin to create an epistemology of practice. Because it was quite clear to me from the very beginning that the discourse of academia and the discourse of practice were very far apart. The discourses were very different for all kinds of reasons. So we had to begin to say to ourselves, well, what is the discourse of practice? And one can use discourse, so I'm told by the sociologists, in at least two ways. One meaning literally the way that people talk. The other one meaning all the things that people practice with a much more deeper meaning, which kind of involves the practice itself and not just the talk about it. And I've been trying to... This is as far as I've got, but each of these things unwraps in a variety of ways. But in order... So the first thing I did was to try and bring out this notion that one could at least tackle these particular elements of practice. And if one looked at those elements of practice more clearly, it might tell us something about how people did their practice and how it worked. Clearly, there's an issue all the time. People have to understand their clients. They have to understand the situations that they're looking at and where they are. They have to make decisions about what they do. They have to pursue an agreed course of action. And they have to monitor themselves if they're responsible and going to take responsibility for their actions. They have to have some kind of metacognitive monitoring of what's going on here. What am I doing? What am I doing to the situations in which I am working? So we have that particular aspect. And there were two things I just want to say at the beginning about these. The first is that when we come to decision-making, there's a lot of material on decision-making in the literature, and much of it started with the assumption that decision-making was about making big decisions, and that people made big decisions that had great consequences. Now, a lot of the research from people who've gone out and tried to look at how people actually make decision-makings in practice suggests that it's very rare that people make big decisions, and it's much commoner for people to make a series of little decisions with all kinds of things in between them. So we begin to get a model not so much of one big decision and you have a great business before it and then lots of application afterwards, but of intervening things where sometimes you're assessing things, sometimes you're making a decision, sometimes you're doing things, and these things are all intertwined in many complex kinds of ways, which gives us a different kind of picture of practice from the grand decision concept that has been there. And the other little issue here is that the small decisions very often are in situations that are changing as you move. So if situations are changing, you make a decision at a certain point, and a little bit later, the situation is different. Now, some of that may have been caused by a decision that you made and something you did, but other things may have been caused by other things that have happened in the situation during that period of time. And other things may happen because you've got new information about those situations from different sources during that period of time as well. So the whole thing is a moving target, as well as being a complex set of things. And we need to be aware of that if we're going to understand the situation. Now, the second one is about the context in which the practice takes place. Now, in a sense, I'm going to be talking about context throughout almost the whole of this course, of this lecture. So what I'm essentially going to do is not say anything about it now, but simply say that the notion of concept is going to grow as we proceed, and let it happen that way. Many important things, I think, grow rather than necessarily get formally taught at one particular time, and I think context is one of those things. Now, the next one is about modes of cognition, and for that I have another slide. Now,
On the left-hand side, we've got our four elements, as before, with all the comments that I made about it. Now, the additional element I'm bringing here is essentially I'm trying to say, well, how are people thinking while they are doing these various things? And the column headings are sort of shorthand for, in essentially, rather different ways of thinking. And at the left hand, I've got something that is practically instant kind of response to something, almost instant actions, or things that are very routinized. In other words, doing things that are very familiar to you without very much thinking. We've got the rapid intuitive kind of situation, where you're having to do things very quickly, and for all sorts of reasons, or you do them either quickly because you can do them quickly, or quickly because they are quick anyway. And you've got deliberate analytic things where people have got some time to think, and how much time you have will very much depend on who you are and what the context is, and what the norms are of the particular kind of work that you're doing. Now, one of the problems here is you can all these happen to some extent within a profession, but you'd say, well, they're not that distinct. These merge into each other to some extent. So you could say, why don't we have a timeline? Just think about a continuous timeline. And I thought about that, and sometimes I've talked about it that way. But the difficulty is that if you, according to which profession you talk about, or which kind of work the people within that profession are doing, or which particular day it is almost sometimes, people may have got more or less time to do things in. And the timeline, I mean, to take an example, if you are a school teacher, then you have very, very little time indeed. So routines punctuated by rapid decisions is very much what it's like being in charge of a class. And the notion that you could stop and have a long think in the middle of the class is just nowhere there. But if you talk about an engineer, I mean, a 10-minute to think in a working day would be a luxury for a school teacher, and it would be like a trifle for an engineer. 10 minutes is almost nothing, because they work on much longer timescales than all the work they're trying to do. And for doing something, you know, in a month might be virtually instant for certain kinds of engineering jobs. And it might be a several-year process for many others. So you can't quite make the timeline concept fit this kind of pattern. And it's more the mode of thinking that I'm thinking about. Now, there's some key issues here to bring out, as well as just the fact that you've got these different modes of thinking going on. And another one is the role of familiarity. As people get more experienced, they've done things more and more, they become more routinized. So people tend, things that started on the right-hand side, you couldn't begin to do it without having to think very hard, gradually move over so you can do them a bit more rapidly. And a lot of things gradually become routinized as you can do them more and more. Now, for many forms of work and many activities, that routinization is absolutely essential. The nature of the job is that you have to do lots of things quickly. And in other ages, they're always trying to ratchet up the productivity anyway. So whichever way you're talking about it, there's always a pressure to move over to the left and away from the right. Yet most workplaces give very little time for people to think very much about what they're doing, certainly to think in any kind of reflective way about what they're doing. And many dangers come from that. Now, another consequence of this is that there are many reasons, therefore, why we have routines. And there are very big advantages to routines. One of the advantages is that if you've routinized a lot of things that you're doing, you have a much lower cognitive load. You're not having to madly think about everything you're doing all the time. And this frees you up in quite a lot of ways. And one of the most important ways it frees you up is to talk to other people. You can talk to your clients. You can talk to your patients. You've got more time to think about that if you're not absolutely worried about, stiff about doing the kind of thing that you're trying to do. And you can talk to your colleagues and so on. So there are important positive aspects of that. And you're far less likely to burn out if you've got a lower cognitive load and not a really high load all the time. It's very, very difficult to sustain that. You'll get illness coming out of it and all kinds of burnout phenomena coming out of that. So there are some positive aspects to it. There are, however, some problems with routines. First, some routines never become very functional, because they become routines for coping with certain things in the environment, but not for actually forwarding the purpose of the profession. And if they're not forwarding the purpose of the profession, then the routines clearly have never been very productive in the first place. And that does happen to some extent. It particularly happens that people are pitched into situations where they have to cope with it very quickly. They learn to cope, but they learn to cope in a way that doesn't match up with being able to do the job well. And it's a very bad way of training people, and I think that's what they tend to do in teacher training, actually, at the moment, and many other things that I can think of. I think they'd do much better off getting the people to help learn how children learn by working with children in small groups, and then at a later stage, beginning to pick up the pressures of a class and handing that thing, so that the thing that you've, in a sense, routinized is how to work with children and help them learn, not routinized how to control a class. So the one that you start first makes a big difference in how you organize and think about that training process. So that one works. Now the next problem that we come to is that routines have a half-life. And the half-life of most professional routines is going down, unfortunately. It's getting shorter all the time because of the rate change. This means that people are being expected to change their routines. Now that is a very difficult thing to ask somebody to do, because your survival as a so-called successful profession, successful means being able to do things quickly, be very productive and get lots of things done in a day, is dependent upon your routines working for you. And if you're then asked to stop them in some way or other or change them, you're in a very, very difficult position. And all the people who talk about changing things seem to ignore what's actually involved in changing your routines, because it's a very difficult thing to do. And there's a huge amount of unlearning involved, as well as relearning. And the unlearning is the most difficult part, because nobody recognizes that it's there, that you have to do it. And, of course, there is a stage when you haven't got a routine. Well, there you are. You're like a novice again, without the excuse of being a novice. That is a very emotional and very distressing experience. And that's what people have been pushed through in various professional change programs all the time. Now, I'm very greatly in favour of change in the professions. I think that's very crucial. But we have to think much more carefully about how we do it and how we try and do it. And that's what we're not doing. So a lot of things come out of just thinking of the implications of that one diagram, which is why I've spent some time on it. And I won't be spending quite so long on the next ones. Now, the next issue I briefly want to talk about is tacit knowledge. And having looked at the previous diagram, you'll begin to see why it is that quite a lot of professional knowledge, and indeed any other kind of knowledge, is fairly tacit. And one of the first things I discovered when I came to Sussex and started working with teachers all the time was the one thing they could never tell me was how they actually taught. And I've discovered that with many other professionals as well, because they do this in routine ways, and in a sense the daily activities that they engage in have become tacit to them, and they're things that they don't explain, they don't have to think about, more or less. Not only that, but there are other sort of reasons why things become tacit, and that is that if you were to talk very precisely in a sort of academic way about what you did every day, then you'd be vulnerable to criticism from other people around the place who might say you've got it wrong, or you've done it wrong, or something like that. So I think in many professional situations, people actually learn, without realizing it, a discourse of deception in which you talk about what you do in order to establish your community with your colleagues, but you don't actually make it too precise because in order to preserve your autonomy. And that applies to your colleagues in some contexts and certainly to your managers. So you have this discourse of deception that runs through this, and I don't think people realize they're doing this. But it essentially means that it is countercultural to try and be at all precise about what you're doing in conversations with your colleagues. I think we need to be aware of these other kind of situations that are there. Now, another form of tacit knowledge I've called implicit aggregation of episodes and impressions, implicit aggregation. Now, you get this, and a very good example of this is medical diagnosis, where you've got the situation whereby a lot of a doctor's informal knowledge is based upon the number of cases they've seen of various kinds and so on and so forth. The evidence seems to be that the aggregation of case experience is based upon lots of case episodes in which people have aggregated these episodes, and means that they're able to spot things. In the context of medicine, there's a lot of checking out what your hunches are and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, you can do things much more quickly because of the experience that you bring to those situations. And that's not an experience that you have, in a sense, thought out as you go along. It's more kind of aggregated awareness of things that have happened to you during that period of time. Hidden constructs, I won't take this much further because I've got a lot of other things to talk about. Knowledge use I will mention to you because I may not have time to come back to this one. And the whole issue of how you start, knowledge comes in a context. And if you try and take that knowledge to a different context, there's a whole lot of transforming and resituating of the knowledge that has to take place when you move from one context to another. And the context of the university and the context of the workplace, the university, of course, itself is a workplace, and we shouldn't forget that. But the context of being a student and the context of being a teacher in a university, if you like, is still a very big one. And how you use the knowledge that you've got in one context in a practical situation is a very big change. Now, I may not get to it, but at the very end of your handouts, you'll find that there are a few notes on transfer of knowledge between contexts that you might like to look at on a future occasion. Skills, you won't be surprised that those are tacit knowledge. I mean, there are many things that people know about. I mean, I don't have to explain to you how I talk. I don't have to explain to you how I ride a bicycle. I don't have to explain to you how I swim. Decision-making, we've talked a little bit about that, and I won't try and take that any further now. So those are the starting to that bit. Now, the next little bit I'm going to talk about is going to be the sort of the basis of some of the things that I'm going to be saying later. And this mainly comes from two ESRC-funded research projects. And these research projects had two sets of, had these three questions, and both of them had these questions. The first one was mid-career, the other one was early career. And I should mention, while I'm on this topic, that there are important colleagues I had working on these projects. In project one, I had Jane Alderton, who was involved in the nursing thing from the University of Brighton, and we also had Gerald Cole and Peter Senker. In his interlude, when he just after he left Sprue, he also worked on the engineering side. Gerald Cole worked on the business side. And the second project, I had six colleagues. Professor Mayaday from the University of Brighton Engineering, Carolyn Miller from the University of Brighton Health, Stephen Seven, who's here with us tonight, special responsibility for the training and the methodology of the project, Emma Alley, Research Fellow for Engineering, Claire Blackman, Research Fellow for Nursing, and Judith Ferner, Research Fellow in Business. In this context, it was accountancy. So my gratitude to them. We had very good groups on both occasions, and a group does an awful lot more than than a set of individuals, or should do. Now, I'm just going to quickly move through a bit more information about this. This gives you an idea as to what we did on those projects. The sort of the numbers were in that sort of 90 to 120 sort of size. And the first one had two interviews, and the final one went over 3 years. So we saw people for the first 3 years of professional work that they were engaged in. And during that time, we visited people 4 times. We observed activities in the work context. We talked to the people around them, and we interviewed the main participants. I'll be telling you a little bit more about that in a moment. Now, the three groups that we chose with have very different modes of preparation and were at different stages in their professional formation. Now, the accountants and engineers were formally contracted as trainees, but the big difference was that the engineers had degrees in engineering. And the trainee accountants, we're talking about chartered accountants in this particular case, had degrees in almost anything. I think there might be one person in our group who had a business degree, and none of them had an accounting degree. So that's what they were really were starting from scratch in many, many ways. And the nurses were already qualified. I ought to explain that the engineers were on company schemes. They were trainee graduate engineers, so they called themselves graduate engineers. And although the nurses were starting work with much more practical experiences, they still could easily have their learning needs neglected, in spite of the official provision of instruction and mentors, which doesn't necessarily guarantee that. So that's where they were. Now, we come to observation. Now, we were not able to do any observation on our previous project. It's likely the mid-career people wouldn't have allowed us to observe them anyway. But observation has got tremendous advantages that are not available so easily to an interview. We're just trying to explain why we found this very important. I mean, firstly, it meant that the person doing the interviewing was much more aware of what was going on around the workplace. They were also enabled to use documents, activities that they observed as starting points for conversations. And when you look at something real and you start talking about it, and when you use it and how you use it, you have a kind of discourse of description, shall we say, when people tell you what they do in a sort of mundane, ordinary kind of way. If you come in and ask people very challenging questions about what they're doing, they normally go straight into what I call the discourse of justification. And the two are very different discourses, and you find out very different things from them. And in our case, what we're trying to do is to start very much about descriptions about what they were doing. And we tried to do that with our mid-career ones as well, to start with descriptions of what they were actually doing and what they were doing perhaps the previous week. If we'd come another week, would it have been different? And what would they be doing a year previously or 2 years previously? We began to get some sense of how they'd changed and what they were doing by talking in those sorts of ways about it. We learnt not to use the word learning, because it actually got us on the wrong track if we did that. Because the moment you use the word learning, people thought you were talking about classrooms and formal training and things of that kind. So we learned not to use that at all until much later on in the situation. And also allowed us to understand the complexity of what was going on much more in that sort of ways. So that's why the observation was very important. And the funding was very crucial to that. Now, this is just the palette of the awe of what happened in that second project. And you can see how many people we had. We've got the gender breakdown of that. The number they were in the first lot of interviews, the number in the third year, the total numbers of interviews, the interviews with managers and team leaders and mentors. Because we got, in a sense, further comments about the environment from those other people. We did not ask them any questions about our participants. But we asked them about their expectations of people in that sort of role and that sort of stage. And so we got that sort of aspect of it from them. And we were not asking them to make any comments on our participants, and we were very careful about that. Nor did we note any. They were quite prepared to stick with that, I'm glad to say. So that moves us on to the next little problem, which is how do people learn? And this seems a very obvious question. And when we first began on our first project, the mid-career one, we talked about formal learning and informal learning and made a kind of distinction there. And that seemed to work for mid-career people. And we were quite surprised, well, perhaps not totally surprised, we found that I think 90% at least of the learning that took place was informal. And that was a very important finding from that first project. Now, when we went to the second one, we thought that there might be more formal learning for people at the very beginnings of their careers. And we knew that the accountants were actually still going to college. There was a kind of outsourced training for them. And they were still taking professional examinations. So that was part of the picture. So they had a formal part built into their program. But nevertheless, even in spite of that, we could say that even among the accountants, nobody was learning more than perhaps 15% from a formal type context. But we found it wasn't very easy to separate formal and informal. Because when you started having mentors, or you started having people who were doing coaching, do you call that formal, do you call it informal? So we gave up on that. We said, well, there's another way of looking at this. If you ask them what they're doing, what do they tell you? If they say they're working, then we'll assume that what they're doing is they're working, they're doing their normal work, and learning is a byproduct. If they say they're learning, as they might do if they were being coached or doing something else in some way or other, then at or near the workplace, then we would describe that as learning. We didn't ask them if it was formal or informal. And we also find, so there were processes that were learning processes and work processes. And then we find there were all sorts of things that happened in the middle, and I'm going to go through these in more detail. Which were little actions that could have been in any of those processes. They couldn't sort of be the one or the other. could be any kind of process that came up in. So we've got three, it's all in one diagram in the handout, but I've got three slides to deal with each of those in turn. And that seems to work very well for us, that particular distinction. But we still found with these people that most of the learning, 80% at least, was the top one, was the work processes, was learning as a byproduct. So it was through the work that they were doing, as they were working, was the key element to it. Now, work processes was learning as a byproduct. This is the kind of range of work processes that we found came under this heading. And I can give you examples of a few of these, just to sort of start the thing going. And if we look at group processes, the kind of things that we found that people were doing was that they would pick up, they would talk about getting a range of perspectives, seeing how people had different kinds of expertise. They would talk about inter-colleague communication, about sort of noticing the group dynamics that was going on, the micropolitics of the group, the micropolitics of the organization they worked in. All these kinds of things were coming out from participating in a whole range of different groups that might be going on around their workplace. And one of the major issues was to what extent were these people getting opportunities to participate in these groups. And that was a major issue very often. There were some places where some people participated, others didn't. Some where none of the younger people participated at all. So, because these groups normally were had working functions. And typically the way that membership of groups that were set up to do various things rather than permanent groups would be almost based on the micropolitics of that part of the workplace. We've had, you know, some of those, someone represents that group, some that group, or the rest of it, all the different professions, whatever it might happen to be. They didn't think of it as being a potential learning context, and one in which people would be learning from. But nevertheless, a lot of people did get some opportunities, and they found that very helpful. Now, working alongside other people, this is hugely important. Now, one of the reasons why it's hugely important is because of the amount of tacit knowledge there is. And one of the things about tacit knowledge is people can't really easily explain it to you. But if you work alongside them, you can see quite a lot of what they're doing. Or you can ask little questions as you go along, or they may tell you a few things as they go along. And the difference in the situation is that you've got quite a lot of knowledge of the content, and you're seeing things. And that means that you don't have to have a long conversation in order to exchange, to share information or to learn something. And that's the advantage of it. And also you can make a note of something and ask soon afterwards. People will usually, if you ask people soon enough after an event about something that happened, you've got a fair chance that they'll remember something about it. If you wait till the next day, they may have forgotten it. They won't be able to recall exactly what it was at that particular moment or remember that. So there's a big issue here about being on the spot and the kind of things that can happen when you're on the spot. And the sort of things that come along there, what I'd call multisensual recognition. There are a lot of work in which people are working with, certainly in, think about healthcare. How do you recognize things in a patient? Now, it's all very mysterious to somebody without any experience. And how do people gradually pick up, begin to learn to recognize things? Now, working alongside people can help in this kind of context gradually. Shorter, quicker communication, I've talked about. Observing actions and communications of the person you're next to. Sort of voice-over explanations. Use of tools. How do people use these things and so on. And other things that come out from that are how do people prioritize? And this is a major, major problem for people coming in new. Very particularly in nursing, particularly in teaching. And pretty important in accountancy as well. How do they learn what is first priority, what is second priority, etc. Because they haven't a clue when they start, even if they're well fully trained. They're not ready for that. Assessment of risk, another situation. That would take quite a while. Yet it's absolutely crucial to practice. It would take quite a while for that. And the accountants have this problem. You know, what is a material risk? What isn't a material risk? And so on and so forth. The fine-tuning to the particular client, the particular context, may be the same thing, but it isn't quite the same thing. has tuned that particular situation in a very fine sort of way, and you begin to realize that they're not actually behaving quite the same way with client A or client B or client C, and beginning to pick up why this might be. So all these things are there to be picked up on in some sort of way. The consolidation of extending and refining skills, like things. There's a nice example here, I'll just read you one, because it's a good example of this episode business. I was talking about that in medicine. Here's one in accountancy. Every audit you go on, you will have picked up things cumulatively from all the other audits you've been on. So if you come across that section again, you might think, last time I had to dig out that as well as that, and cross-reference that back. So if you just took two snapshots, one of when you start and one of now, your work would be completely different. But rather than being one specific incident, it's more cumulative, especially as the jobs are fairly short. So, again, they're describing how you gradually find that you can do more and more and aware of more and more, but you can never pin it down to any particular moment, any particular situation. And another one where something's prompted, a nurse describing that was beginning to get a little bit more confident in monitoring drug doses, and then is trying to go a little bit beyond that. I think it's something I've just learned very recently, just looking at people's drugs and realizing why they're on them, and questioning with the doctors whether they still need to be on them, or whether the doses need to be upped or downed, or things like that. That's something I've observed in other nurses. The basics are starting to really click now, and I'm thinking, well, why does this person need to be on this drug, for instance? I think just practice and questioning the doctors and be told the rationale as well. I think the rationale is beginning to stick now for why certain patients are on certain drugs and what the correct doses should be. So you've got a kind of monitoring by the nurses of these things going on when they've got to a certain stage and began to learn this particular way. And I've called that a kind of consolidating extending fund. So those are kind of examples of the sort of things that go on there. Now, moving on to the next group. Learning processes at or near the workplace. Now, clearly being supervised and being coached are fairly crucial things, and I'll give you one or two examples of this one. There's a very nice one from engineering. You see the senior engineers, the people like David, you watch how they manage a project. And if your mentor's good, he will start feeding in bits and pieces. When you're comfortable with it, he'll give you a little bit more. When you're comfortable with that, he'll then give you a little bit more. With time, you're doing pretty much everything he was doing. And he's happy because that's one less responsibility for him. He's invested the time in training you. Your capability is now better, and he can concentrate on other issues. Now, interesting thing is how many mentors actually see that, or how many organizations see this kind of investment as going on when good mentoring is taking place. And I have to say that engineering was one of the professions in which there was very little good mentoring, but I thought it was nice to give you a good example. Another one here, coaching from accountancy. I only just knew what a debtor was when I went to them, the senior people, and they sat down and just talked through the test and how they'd do it. And you went off and got all the information, tried it out yourself, and then any problems, take it to the senior. By the senior, by the way, they mean a senior trainee, not a junior trainee. And I'll just finish this and then I'll explain that further. I almost had to be talked through the first few things when I was doing it. Once you've done it once, even though each company does things a bit differently, you don't need nearly as much help the second time you do it. And one of the very interesting features of accountancy was that the people were getting most of their learning from people only a few months ahead of them, or possibly a bit more than that. Now, this worked extremely well for a whole host of reasons. But one of the main reasons was that people who were just ahead of you had been where you were within their very recent memory, and you could ask lots of silly questions and get away with it because they'd just be there. Whereas if someone very senior, you'd never feel that you could ask them silly questions. Now, remember, these accountants hadn't got any backward training in accountancy. So they were bound to ask lots of silly questions and had to, and they were encouraged to, and they were more or less told that they didn't ask questions, you know, they'd be in trouble. They must ask questions and not sit idle. And the whole culture is that of asking questions in that kind of way. And then we had an engineering one. But site visits are good. They let you meet the client. They let you see what you're designing. They also complete the picture. You get a better idea of what they want by just meeting them and talking to them, seeing the place, being on site How much you learn from a development point of view is probably more social, from the interaction side with people from all walks of life, whether he's a maintenance engineer or the power development manager for a particular project. I think they probably underestimate that, by the way. But what you bring back is project-specific information that's going to help the work that you have to do. So we're beginning to pick up that. Now, one of the problems, again, we had with engineers was not enough of them were getting site visits, particularly if they were electrical engineers or electronic engineers. And that was a major problem. Making for a qualification. This is an interesting one for the accountancy people, saying it's a combination, really. It's not so much college, that's what they call the training company they went out to, as the knowledge you get from college. And you understand the issues you're talking about more. That helps your confidence. It's a lot easier to talk about stuff you understand. So that was their kind of response to that. Now, moving on to the next one. We're not talking about all kinds of little things that people fit in and get this. And they learned a huge amount, not only about did they ask a lot of questions, but they began to learn about how they ask questions. One accountant trainee said, so often by asking them how they do things their own way, you can find out how it's normally done. So instead of asking them something directly, he says, well, what's the way you do this here? And then they tell him what's going on, and his ignorance doesn't get shown up in that way. Because on the whole, when you visit a client, they assume that you know everything they do. So he's kind of found a very clever way of doing that, and that was this trainee. He just picked it up. I don't think he got that from anybody else. And that helps you get a better understanding of what's going on. Or another one. You need to speak to the right people. And you need to figure who the right people are. So there's a lot of kind of, this is on the client premises, how do you find the right person to talk to in that place? And he's the one you've really got to go and talk to about this problem that you've discovered with a bit of the accounts and all the rest of it. There's a lot of that having to go. And then when we're talking on from the engineers, talking about, this is really about locating resource people also. Well, you go to T for a section of the work, but he's not possibly the most helpful of people. He sometimes doesn't understand what you're asking, or doesn't give you a very full answer. If I've got a problem I really feel is important, I'll go to J or P. It's not that T is less approachable, it's just that I find J's input to my situation is more constructive, more helpful. Now, the very interesting thing about that was T was his mate who sat next to him, a little bit ahead of him, and J was his manager. So we've got the situation here where he's finding out that he found his manager a very good person to get things from, and not approaching his mate with someone who didn't seem to understand what he was arguing about. So you've got a kind of counter-argument there to the one I was just saying about the accountants coming out in that context. So that's interesting. Learning from mistakes, a nice counter-argument on this one here from the nurse. I found on this ward that when I make a mistake, then they tell me what I should have learned, instead of helping me to learn first. In other words, a situation where they felt it would have been better if they'd been taught first. But obviously there are other situations where learning from mistakes is a very critical part of the whole process. Now, at the very bottom there, I'm coming to feedback in a moment, use of mediating artifacts. You may wonder what on earth I'm talking about when I talk about mediating artifacts. Essentially, there can be objects of any kind. They may be textual objects, they can be physical things, they could be photographs. They are things that sort of convey information that people can talk about. And I would argue you could regard a book as a mediating object in just the same way. Now, I think one of the interesting functions about these, and we find lots of examples of them. I mean, in accounting, they always had their audit files. They had the files of last year's audit. So there's always something someone could go and look at, and which gave them some kind of sense of where they were. And they could look at what other people had done as well. So you picked it up in that kind of way. Then we had design specifications, or circuit diagrams, or pictures of things that they were making for engineers being used. Or we had handover notes, very critical part for nurses when one shift takes over from another, with all sorts of shorthand abbreviations in them of various kinds. And all these were very crucial things. Now, the key point about these mediating artifacts is not the artifacts themselves represent the knowledge, but the conversations that take place around the artifacts are create the knowledge, as it were. Now, I would argue that even if someone came and they filled up an examination paper and wrote an examination paper and used that as an artifact, that artifact, in some sense, wouldn't really create the knowledge there was in that area. But if they had long conversations with other people about what they'd written, that would begin to reveal some of the knowledge that was around in that sort of area that people might pick up and be able to understand. So the artifacts, in a sense, are sort of bring on the knowledge. Now, very quickly, I want to talk about settings for feedback, because feedback is one of the most crucial things in learning. And I want to point out that there are these different kinds of settings in which it happens. And it's quite important to be aware of that. Because the first one is, particularly for people in their early career position, immediate comment on what you're doing on the spot, soon after the event is possible, by someone who is there, if possible. And one of the things we found out is where that works, it's by far the best feedback that people can get. And if the thing gets left, even the person themselves that had a problem has forgotten the next day what the problem was that they would like to have asked that person. And that can very easily happen. So it's... Now, the problem with putting people as mentors is that they may not be the people who are on the spot at that time. But the people on the spot may feel, well, it's the mentor's job to do that. And therefore, we don't think we've got any responsibility for that. And it became very obvious to us that if the people around someone who was an early career person felt that they had some responsibility for supporting that person, giving them on-the-spot feedback in an appropriate kind of way, and that was when learning really zoomed, as it were. And it was very important that that possibility was there. There could also be informal conversations away from the job, some of which may have conveyed indirect similar sorts of things, but sometimes there are unintended messages get overheard, shall we say, which make people think things that may or may not be what was actually meant by the person that said them, because they may not have been fully aware of the context of it, but can be very upsetting to many people. And the number of people who get upset by unintended messages can be quite high. The formal role I've talked about of someone as a mentor or supervisor ought to be more that they've got responsibility for the learner's progress and some obligation to provide formative feedback on a regular basis. But they can't be the only person that is helping that learner and supporting what they're doing and giving feedback to them. It's very rare that that's going to be the most effective way of doing things. So in effect, what we're going to say is that people in general need to be able to do that and support each other. And I think that applies to people at any stage in their practice. Now, appraisal, I won't say much more about it, except to say that in all our work, we haven't come across any organisation that felt it got appraisal absolutely right. They're always saying, well, we're rethinking our appraisal because it isn't quite working. And we feel that there are some reasons behind this, probably, and we're trying to think about that. But there are two that we've thought about. One is that there isn't a relationship, much of a relationship between the two people involved. And the other is that the kind of feedback that the person is getting relies, needs information and judgment on that information that the appraiser doesn't actually have. In other words, it may not be the appraiser's fault, they just don't have the kind of information that the appraiser is seeking from them. So those are just hypotheses, and I can't sort of give you any more information on that. But I felt I had to mention that. Now, I think I'd better move very fast from here, and I just want briefly to talk about the factors that affect learning in these kind of contexts that we were looking at. And I've got two triangles here, and these we call it our two-triangle model. And this one, we've called it the learning factors. And in each of these triangles, we've got the work at the top left, we've got relationships top right, and we've got the individual at the bottom. And essentially what we're saying here is that key factors for the work, if you like, starting with confidence, there's always a very close, this applies equally well with mid-career people, a very close connection between someone's confidence and their learning, and the amount that they're learning. They go together. And what makes someone confident? People become confident when they do something that is challenging, and they achieve something that's challenging, but something they've done over and over again, that doesn't make them confident. But it's confidence in themselves able to do things, but there's also an issue of confidence in their colleagues. It's also very important. So that brings us back to feedback and support that people get. Do they have confidence in their colleagues, or are they just going to be blamed and, you know, given a metaphorical hit over the head if they don't quite get something right? And there's also an important role for personal agency and motivation that comes in there. So, and the value of the work is also important. People are going to be committed to the work if they think it's valuable. They're going to lose commitment to that work if they don't think it's valuable work. They don't think it's helping anybody. Or they don't even know where the work is going. Some of the engineers who are working on very, very long-term projects might be lasting 5 years. Then you weren't sure that it would get built then. And had no sort of sense of what the whole part bit was that they were doing little bits for. Clearly had no sense of the value of what they were doing in that way. And on the whole were sort of very little contact with other people in relation to their work as well. So we had huge problems with others, had all sorts of people around, they're working on site with people, connecting with people in all sorts of ways. So you had the really the best learning environments and the worst learning environments could be found in engineering. But very often there, it was kind of the organisation at a higher level that was creating the problem. Now, whereas in nursing, the organisation at the local level was much the most important. So we found the very best example, we found the very worst example, were in the same department of the same hospital, in almost in different wards. So the people in charge were so different than the senior people in charge there. And that's a crucial issue there. And I don't think making sort of lots of fancy changes to the system is necessarily going to solve that particular problem. I think you have to grow your learning, your people, particularly I think in the nursing context. I think you have to grow a ward with a different kind of culture, with a learning supportive culture, and by moving people into it, perhaps, you know, a new manager with a few people with it, and try and do about 4 or 5 a year over a 5-year period. And that's, I think, the best way in which you're going to be able to turn them around. And I ought to add, while I'm on this, that anything that's good for learning is also good for retention, and it's also good for quality improvement. So it's a much bigger package than you think when you start talking about why you should do learning in working organisations. Now, next one is the context factors. And again, we've got the work and the relationships and the individual. Now, the top left is very critical here because the allocation and structuring of the work has a huge effect on people's learning opportunities and whether they get appropriately challenged. We've found examples where people were very under-challenged, particularly the electronic engineers, in situations where they were particularly over-challenged. And in this particular case, this was true of most of the newly qualified nurses, were very seriously over-challenged when they first started. And I think it's also true to a very considerable extent of newly qualified teachers. And certainly the work that Angie and Viv and Carol were doing on that sort of verified that is also true for them. And another issue when talking about allocation is who are you working with? Allocating people to work together, if you're thoughtful about that, can make a huge difference to the amount of learning opportunities that people have and being aware of that. So that's where that bit fits together. So I'm now just going to try and wind up. And I just want to whiz through the final parts, and I'll miss through that one, but clearly the learning culture I've been hinting at. Now the next one is about the role of managers. Now it's quite clear that managers have a major role to play here, and I think the key point is in their leadership in particular. In other words, they shouldn't be doing it all themselves. They should be trying to see that their staff as a whole are supporting each other's learning and that they are mutually trusted in an appropriate way. And there's a mutuality about that. So the issue of feedback comes up, the issue of mutual support, and to use their authority for and or influence on the organisation and allocation of work to create opportunities for learning and quality improvement. And to enhance and extend the understandings and capabilities of the work group as a whole. Now, groups do not create themselves these days. They may have had in the past, but groups change their personnel too frequently. So you have to have some responsibility, not just for managers, but for managers and other senior people within the group that they manage, to take some responsibility for that. And at the moment, none of this happens in management training. You may be surprised by that, but it seems to be a totally ignored area, yet it's absolutely critical. So if we're talking about the conclusions and recommendations here coming out of this, and we've got a dissemination project funded by the ESRC for this calendar year to do precisely this. If anybody here thinks that they can help in any way, please see me afterwards. So the same management style as the point about learning, retention, quality improvement, and that management is training for promoting all three outcomes in an integrated manner, not separately. Hence, the organisation itself needs to develop effective approaches to planning, conducting and evaluating such training and ways of encouraging and supporting managers in this new role. Because our managers have been giving feedback on the way in which they support learning. If that doesn't happen, the whole thing you might as well give up. So that's a crucial point as well. And it has to be an integral part of management development and appraisal and incorporated into management qualifications. And I think that's if you're really saying how are we going to enhance learning in this country today, when we're talking about vocational and professional qualifications, that's what has to happen. I'll stop there.
We have a short amount of time for questions, so who would like to fire some questions at Michael?
I was very interested to hear about your example of how learning was paced from your an engineering example. And I'm particularly interested in the way people certainly supervisors can learn to pace learning, because it seems to me that with the pressure of change and in the workplace with groups changing constantly, one of the things that people often find is they're overloaded, especially at the beginning of their career. So I'd be very interested in any insights that you have about that whole pacing of information and learning.
Well, I think if somebody recognises that's important, that's sort of halfway there. I think the next thing is to, in a sense, try and do a little quiet investigation of it, nothing very sort of special, it doesn't have to be very sort of, and get a sense of what the sort of nature of the problem might be, perhaps get two or three people to get to think about it and see if they could think about ways of handling it. But if you can get some of the younger people and some of the old people together to try and think that one through, that could be very helpful for them. But it has to be specific to the particular context. I mean, I couldn't sort of generalise for any situation I didn't know about.
I was very interested, Michael, in what you were saying about the newly qualified nurses and people who are starting work with more practical experience and sometimes their learning needs being neglected. And I wondered what you found was most effective for those sorts of people, presumably not to go back to square one, but how could their learning be best enhanced?
Right. Well, what's one thing that's happened in that area, I should say, is that the... one of the hospitals that we were working with, and we haven't given the names of any of the institutions that we're working with deliberately on this one until they've sort of decided that they're happy to be associated with it. One of them actually is engaged in some action research with us. This was built into the project for that, to try and do things for this newly qualified nursing group. And then one or two things didn't quite get right on that one, but they then went back into that again. And then they suddenly started in situations where, for financial reasons, people were starting removing nurses away. And this initiative that was going well suddenly sort of foundered, as things sometimes do in that context. But essentially, the biggest problem
is prioritization at the beginning, learning how to delegate things. And there's a sense of, and a key question is, who are they working with is very important, and which sort of patients are they working with, links with that, because that can affect the extent to which they're stretched and the extent to which they feel supported. So I think what I was saying about changing the culture of wards is very important for that. But I think recognising that prioritisation is a big problem, and you can't really teach people that until they actually have that range of responsibilities. And, for example, they can't do anything with drugs until they've qualified anyway. So it's a question of being aware that that's a very thing and trying to sort of have someone who can go through those sorts of things with them fairly regularly and check that they're gradually managing and learning to do certain things, and also see that their loads are appropriate for what they can manage at that point.
You've looked at three particular groups. Many of us in the audience are academics, and you could argue that we learn through many ways, but frequently it's the PhD that's regarded as research training. And many academics now at the start of their career have to undertake some sort of formal teaching qualification. Have you got any insights for us about whether that's right, or whether there are any advice you can give us on how we support academics in the earlier stages of their careers?
Yes, I could suggest talking on. Well, I'll talk about the teaching qualification if you like. But the thing that immediately occurs to me is, and this comes very much from work, we also had a research project on transfer of innovative practices between schools. Carol was involved in that, and if you took what was happening in that, where you had two people working together, joint working of some kind, that was the way that people tended to do that. So the first thing I would think would be to have people starting off teaching a course jointly in some way or other, and then gradually they would plan the thing roughly together, and obviously the experienced person would have some sense as to how much content you could handle in that time, more than, whereas the new person coming wouldn't have much idea about that, as to what would be an appropriate amount of content to handle in a particular time. So advice would gradually get passed across. And then very soon, the new person will start taking responsibility within that. And it's perfectly possible with two people, actually, to think how you can actually do a lecture that way. So they might do part of the lecture rather than the whole of it first time. And so you can gradually take on more responsibility as you go. And ideas might, and also, you can say, well, if we've got two people here, could we actually do something slightly less conventional in the form of the way that we run the show? Or can somebody sort of see what's happening in the background while I'm doing this, or whatever it may happen to be. They're ways of collaborating. So I would say working alongside someone else is a very good way of trying to pick things up. And obviously we know that there's a lot of trial and error involved, but the question is, are they getting good advice at that particular stage? And I think that would be an issue to go with. Or sometimes, I'd have thought, quite an early stage, if there were, of course, usually they won't be in the same department, but they still might be able to help each other. But two people starting together, if they could occasionally sit in each other's places and make comments for each other and help in that sort of way, I think that would help again. So I think the great thing is feedback. Some sense of obvious things that people learn over time, and feedback on your own performance that helps you improve and think through things. So that would be my suggestion.
Last question, possibly.
Michael, have you shared your insights with managers? Do these resonate with their own beliefs?
Occasionally, I think would be my answer. But I mean, I don't have access to lots of managers together in any particular way, and not necessarily in a kind of context where you'd be able to have the sort of conversations that you'd be wanting to have, or the kinds of activities that you'd be wanting to have. But, I mean, I have talked to a very large number of people about some of these things, and I don't find them contradicting me. Most of them seem to feel that it's quite an accurate picture of their experiences. I think the question is where to find the ways through into that thing. And I suspect that this notion of a package that increase learning and retention quality improvement is probably the best starting point, because that is going to look much bigger on the scene than something else. And also this whole issue about if you train people up quickly, you begin to have a thing that moves. I mean, the accountants were very determined that they were trying to get people into certain levels of responsibility quicker. And they saw this as being a way in which they could improve their whole company if they were able to do that. And this had a big effect on the way they run through. They saw this being financially good for them. And they also charged time for the trainees. The trainees knew that. And that made them feel differently about what they were doing as well. They knew that their time was being charged for, so they better do some work and get things done and so on.